Do you have your tickets yet? This is officially going to be the shortest ad in Living Church podcast history. Quick reminder to get your tickets for the Awe and Presence Conference if you don't have them yet. We're going to explore what it means to worship with the church of the past, what the body does in worship, how liturgy works, understanding the story we're in, and George Herbert on prayer. What could get better than that? Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. I would love to see you in St. Louis.
This isn't about making an institution stronger, except that only in service of creating more faithful participants and disciples in the mission of God.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. I'm happy to share with you today a very special guest.
It's great to be here.
Oh, hello, the Reverend Matthew S.C. Olver, PhD, Executive Director of the Living Church. I was just about to introduce our podcast guest for this episode. What's up? Why are you here?
Actually, I was wondering whether I could help you introduce him.
Sure. Not only are you today's interviewer, so this totally makes sense, but I also wanted to talk with you about a couple of things that you mentioned in your interview with
the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, the Most Reverend Sean Rowe.
See, you're already a natural, Matthew. Today, we'll hear Matthew sit down with Bishop Sean. Bishop Sean has already been in office now for a few months, and they will talk about his priorities for his term in office and what slimming down some of the structures of the Episcopal Church might look like.
I also asked him what he'd say to Episcopalians who disagree about same-sex marriage, what Christian unity means, and what he most wants the Anglican Communion and the Anglican Church in North America to know about him.
Now, for those listeners who are not Episcopalians or who are curious about ecumenical and inter-Anglican dialogues but aren't up on all the acronyms, I've got a couple of questions for you, Matthew.
Fire away.
Okay, so you refer in your conversation to TREK. Can you just tell our listeners what that is?
Yes. So TREK is not the bike company based in Wisconsin, where I live.
those are great bikes, by the way.
They are. We have a bunch of TREKs. I love them. But this was a group that was formed by the 2012 General Convention, and it's an acronym for the Task Force for Reimagining the Episcopal Church. And that includes the current presiding bishop and the current president of the House of Deputies, Julia Ayala Harris, Bishops Michael Curry and Andy Doyle. Andy Doyle is the Bishop of Texas. And this task force proposed a bunch of structural changes to the 2015 General Convention to consider, but most of them were not taken up. So it was lots of ideas, but there was not actually a lot of effect in structures after that.
And you also talk about the General Convention. I think just by its name, most people can figure out what that is if they don't already know. This is the meeting of all Episcopalians, held every 3 years, particularly of Episcopal leaders. Decisions are made, sometimes decisions are not made, etc. But you also mentioned Church Center. Can you tell us what Church Center is?
Sure. The Church Center is one way of referring to the headquarters of the Episcopal Church. That's the staff of the presiding bishop, the staff that supports the Executive Council. The address of the building is 815 2nd Avenue in New York City, and people often use the shorthand 815 to refer to the headquarters and to the staff.
And it also sounds super cool to say the 815. Finally, we have the Nairobi-Cairo proposals. Bishop Sean refers to these in some of his responses to you. What are the Nairobi-Cairo proposals? I also want to say they're pertinent to ACNA folks as well as Episcopalians and global Anglicans. So what are they?
The Nairobi-Cairo proposal is the most recent text to be issued by the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Unity, Faith, and Order, which is maybe one of the longest names of anything. It's abbreviated IASCUFO, which also sounds kind of ridiculous. But this group is one of the main places where the Anglican Communion does its theological and ecclesiological reflection. It's a permanent commission of the Anglican Communion, and it reports to all of the instruments of the Anglican Communion. So that's the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Primate's Meeting, and the Anglican Consultative Council and the Lambeth Conference when it meets. Mm-hmm. So its brief is to advise the instruments and member churches on matters of doctrine, ecclesiology, liturgy, canon law, ecumenical relations. So these proposals, the Nairobi-Cairo proposals, have been written as an offer to the whole Anglican Communion family, providing proposals intended to help Anglican churches navigate difference and divisions while upholding the call of all Christians to sustain the unity of the church. So in the interview, I'll summarize a number of the key proposals that they make in that text.
Okay, that's really helpful. We'll look forward to that. And then, of course, we also refer to the ACNA or ACNA, and that is the Anglican Church in North America. This is an Anglican branch founded in 2009. Your average ACNA parish is generally more conservative than your average Episcopal parish, and some see the ACNA as a way to be Anglican without being progressive in the United States. And not officially at this point part of the communion, but they are certainly in conversation with, recognized, embraced by other Anglicans around the world. And I think other listeners will recognize the institutional significance of the ACNA and maybe some similar patterns and relationships in their own denominations too.
Now, whether you're in TEC, ACNA, the SBC, the AOG, or any other Christian group that does its business with an alphabet soup, it's time for a chat with the PB. That is the presiding bishop.
This has been a long intro today, but I hope it's been helpful. Matthew? Ready to take it away?
Let's go.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Bishop Sean, thank you so much for being here today. It's great to have you on the Living Church podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I don't think we've ever really had the chance to have a conversation at length. We did interact some at General Convention last summer in Louisville. I think I reached out to you as the parliamentarian of the House of Bishops with some wonky canonical questions, which you were only too happy to answer.
You only get one or two of those every convention, so that...
Exactly. Well, you were excited enough by my question that I realized I had found something of a kindred spirit, so I...
there are only a few of us that care that much.
Exactly. So my sense of your preferential option for the wonky was only increased after your election. There was a bishop who quipped to me that you had been building the church of the future in your basement for the last 15 years. And which only made me think of Will Ferrell's character at the end of the Lego movie, who has built this like massive city in his basement. But I think it was clearly a compliment. Yes. when they said that. So would wonky be the word that you would self-describe, or what would be like the proper adjective in your kind of inclination toward the technical and the system focused?
Well, you know, yeah, sure. I'm probably wonky, probably organizational wonk. But the thing is, it's organizational wonk in service of the gospel. At least that's what I tell myself. And I actually believe that all of this matters. And it kind of only does in terms of our ability to preach and carry forth a winsome gospel message. But oh yeah, I'm a total wonk, and I love I love canon law and bylaws and rules and all those sorts of things in service of the larger. Yep. I think strong institutions, and we got to be a little wonky to love them. Strong institutions help us do what we do.
Exactly. Well, let me give our listeners a little bit of context to your time in office. The last two elections for presiding bishop in the Episcopal Church occurred, I think, pretty decisively, and on the first ballot. Michael Curry received 71% of the vote. You, I think, were well over 50%. And I think most observers would see in each of these elections a desire for change of some kind. And when you addressed us in the House of Deputies, I was a deputy at General Convention, after you were elected on June 26, you listed four areas where you think that change is necessary. It was kind of a vision you set out. And so I'm going to rehearse those really briefly for the listeners so they can know that. Sure. So the first was reorienting national budgets and staff to support dioceses and congregations. And you took the first major step and public step with that a few weeks ago with significant staff changes that were tied to the budgetary requirements that General Convention and Executive Council had set. The second, you said, was we need to, quote, reform our structures and governance so that our essential polity does not collapse under its own weight. I think there was much cheering in the House of Deputies when you said that, though I think there were probably a few people looking around thinking, really?
what are we going to do?
Right.
Third, you said we need to support and encourage the work of, quote, juncture and reunion of dioceses. And fourth, you said we need to, quote, commit to creating a beloved community in which we can disagree without shaming or blaming or tearing each other apart. So I'd like to engage with all of those in some way. And I want to start with the third one, that the one about juncture and reunion of dioceses. I've heard you give a strong critique of a certain Episcopal quip, and you actually did this at Episcopal Parish Network a couple weeks ago in Kansas City. Episcopalians, I've heard them say, you know, we may be shrinking in numbers, but we're deeper than ever. And you said, you don't see any evidence of that, and you think that's a kind of self-deception. Let's not hide behind our failure of how supposedly deep we are. So my first question is this. So other than the solid practical reasons, what do you think is the proper theological interpretation of these reunions and junctures of dioceses? How do you think this theological vision might help us face the reality of our situation and address our failures to grow?
Well, thanks for that. I think the conviction behind my way of thinking about this is the idea that we are one church, regardless of our judicatory divisions. So Jesus Christ has already made us one. We've been entrusted with the church, which is the risen body of Christ in the world. And so these experiments in reunifying, juncturing, partnering, and I think there are other ways. I don't think reunifying and juncturing dioceses is the answer to everything, right? I mean, and it may or may not be in certain contexts. I think partnerships, for example, greater collaborations, the ability for us to see ourselves rather than 100 and some dioceses. What if we saw ourselves as a single church? That's really more what I'm getting. So our ability to make disciples and witness to the good news, I think, is directly proportional to our ability to work together and to think of ourselves as in this enterprise together. You know, the solid practical reasons, as you call them, you know, service of freeing up resources, but for the purpose of, you know, back what we used to say back in the day, the prosecution of God's mission. This isn't about propping up an institution. This isn't about making an institution stronger, except that only in service of creating more faithful participants and disciples in the mission of God. That's our critical task. And this idea that we're somehow smaller as a church, but deeper, I think it's deceptive. If we're really deeper, if the discipleship is deeper, then we're making more disciples. And right. We're clearly not. So at least at the level that we could.
Right. And I think that, you know, other denominations and traditions that are even quite far from us have made similar sort of recognitions, right? So, I mean, famously, the great seeker-sensitive church in Chicago, Bill Hybels Church, they issued a report that basically said, we got bigger and our people are as shallow as ever, and we really failed. And so I think that, you know, in the same way at EPN, you know, that the Pew study had just come out and lots of people were talking about that, about the something of a pause maybe in some of the decline, but that these numbers seem to affect basically all of the Christian traditions, at least in the United States or the West more broadly. It's not sort of peculiar to the Episcopal Church or to this church or that church. So maybe staying in the same vein about structures. Your second goal was reforming structures and governance. So I'm interested, and you served on TREC.
I did.
With the President of the House of Deputies, Julia Ayala Harris, who, in fact, she and I were on brother-sister floors our freshman year of college together,
and
which we realized when we reconnected at General Convention, the previous one in 22 in Baltimore. So I'm interested in what you think a reformed and functioning General Convention would look like, and a reformed church center structure that is actually resourcing parishes and dioceses, as you have been talking about. So maybe start with General Convention and then church center.
I think when it comes to the General Convention, we get sometimes sidetracked about like how big it should be or how long it is, rather than thinking about what is it? What are we doing? And this is what we try to get at with the Trek conversations, and I think it planted some seeds. But where we are now is, I think, in a place that we need to strengthen our capacity for governance and leadership that supports institutional change, the change in the church that allows a more effective participation in God's mission. So, you know, we need to reduce the capacity that's lost when governance structures are not aligned with our strategy and vision for the church's future. Really, too often, we continue to have these unaligned structures, so they don't really work. They served a church of another era, of another time. So we're looking at now, what is the General Convention's mandate? And the President of the House of Deputies and I are both working hard at this. What is the General Convention's mandate, both theological, most importantly, and canonical? So we're looking at things like its schedule, technology, legislative processes, worship programming. And as a committee of deputies and bishops begins to look at all of these aspects of convention, I'm hoping that they suggest some innovations and experiments to try in 2027. So we don't have to change the whole thing overnight. We don't have to make permanent changes or shifts. But I think we can get to a place where we're actually having Bible study together. We're talking about these things that we think are important. We're talking about the place of the church in the world. We're actually grappling with our decline and what that means in our context and how we can present a more winsome gospel. So my way of thinking about this, let's say we try something in 2027 and it doesn't work. Well, here's an idea. Don't do it again. But we know that what we're doing now isn't quite hitting the mark. So why not try to shift? So that's what I think about General Convention.
Can you identify maybe some places where you, examples of misalignment, or could you name some ideas that you have been thinking about that you want to try?
Well, sure. Well, I think we have, like, you know, say at a given General Convention, we might have 700 or 800 resolutions that we treat them basically equally. What if we had priorities and we said, we're going to focus on these particular issues, and these are the things we're going to give our Bible study, our discernment, because the only way to do discernment isn't through debate. And I, you know, I love a good debate. You know, I love a good floor debate. I love me some parliamentary procedure. I mean, I'm a registered parliamentarian. We started at the top of this podcast, we're saying I'm a wonk. But it's not the only way. In fact, it's not the most effective way, particularly as we're grappling with these deep theological issues. So where I think we're misaligned is that we don't have the main thing isn't the main thing. Or we can't agree on what the main thing is.
Yeah.
So if we could spend the time in conversation and prayer and discernment and Bible study with each other instead of debate, so it's not about, like, you know, can I win a point here? I mean, and you can script these debates by now, right? I mean, you can just pretty much, we can predict what's going to be said. But discernment doesn't really work that way. I think in kind of deep discernment. So I think we're not aligned to our own principles as Christians, I don't think, in the best possible ways.
Yeah.
So I think that also the way it's done, the structure itself is unwieldy. And ultimately, this is not original to me. One of my bishop colleagues, I think, said, you know, there aren't enough of us anymore to have an us and them. I mean, we really need to be in this together. And I really believe that.
A question maybe around that point that you just made. There were too small to be an us and them. So your fourth area about where change is necessary, obviously the Episcopal Church at the last General Convention made a definitive move in its doctrine of marriage. And I think it almost certainly after the next General Convention, there will be a marriage liturgy in the prayer book, which same-sex couples can use. So how would you advise Episcopalians who adhere to different teachings on marriage to live in the deepest kind of communion possible?
I think in recent years, we've made significant progress in terms of learning to focus on what we agree about rather than what we disagree. We're not there yet in all places and across all settings, but we're on the path. I think efforts like communion across difference, which you've been involved in, those are the kind of conversations that need to be taking place. I think we're learning, and I emphasize learn because we certainly haven't arrived, but how to move forward together with respect for one another and for the belovedness of all God's people, and, you know, recognizing that our theological differences may be significant. I mean, we can't minimize them, but we are united in our commitment to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to the safety and dignity of all people. And I think we know how to do that in the Episcopal Church. It's part of our tradition.
Yeah. I had some conversations, both at General Convention and EPN, with some people around, I think, a sense of a change of culture in the Episcopal Church. I mean, I think that maybe 20, 25 years ago, if you would have tried to predict what the Episcopal Church would be like at present, I think there's a bunch of ways in which you would have been really wrong. And I think one of those is that around some of these differences, that I think that the prediction would have been that there would have been more polarization, and that there, for some of these, there would only be one opinion about certain questions that were a point of difference. And because I think and this is what a friend of mine sent this at EPN, you know, some of the leaders, it was kind of a scorched earth policy. You know, if you didn't agree, like, get out. And I think the generation that followed those leaders, it's a very different posture. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that if you're somebody who is giving yourself to ordained ministry, your commitment level has to be pretty high. Because, I mean, I'm continually surprised by just how many people of extreme capacity are giving themselves to ordained ministry in the Episcopal Church. And it means that they have lots of other options. There's lots of other things they could do where they could be successful, mm-hmm. where they could make more money. And I think the only real reason to give yourself to this is if you, like, believe it all the way down. You think this actually matters about, like, the structure of reality is centered in the reality of Jesus Christ, come in the flesh, died, and risen. And some sort of, like, poetic reading of the whole Bible, it's sort of like, I'm not going to give 45 years of my life and make things challenging for my family and all these things, right? And I find that deeply encouraging. And I think that it makes possible a kind of communion across difference around lots of questions when that is the anchor. I don't know if that resonates with you, if that's what you see, and how you respond to that.
I mean, it's actually a brilliant insight. I hadn't thought about it quite in those terms. I agree with you. I think that there's something about this, our conviction that Christ is at the center, and it's in the dying and rising, and in the context of that Paschal mystery that we understand and see the world we live in, that needs to animate us. I mean, it is the grounding. It is what matters. Then the other questions we can go at faithfully and through discernment, and we'll wrestle with the deep theological questions the way the church has always wrestled with them, which is slowly and over time, but with a renewed common commitment. That's really, really interesting. What it must have been like 25 years ago to think we would have been wrong about some of our predictions. I think you're right about that. That's really, really interesting.
Another moment where this crystallized for me was at EPN. Scott Gunn, the executive director of Forward Movement, gave an amazing talk that was both simultaneously distressing and heartening. And the distressing part was, you know, they've been doing work with congregations, and so they have a lot of data, something like almost 370 churches that they did surveys with. And the distressing part was just how shallow and a lot of congregations were, and a connection to like believing the Bible has authority in your life, or that Jesus is who he says he is, or any of these things. But then the program that he laid out was just basic teaching about basic Christian living and belief. And this, again, was one of those moments I thought, okay, what he is describing here, I mean, I went to Wheaton College. There was nothing in his presentation that anybody at Wheaton College would have not only had any objection to, they would have been amening from the back. And you had this room of like 80 Episcopal leaders who were all, everyone was tracking with him. And that too, I thought, I don't know if even that kind of language that was expressly, and now I'm going to use the word evangelical in just the literal sense.
Yes, yes.
I don't know if that's what Episcopalians, how they were talking or even thinking 25 years ago, but a lot of them are now. And I think that's really remarkable.
It's remarkable. I think it's a testament to the work the Spirit is doing in the church. I think my predecessor, Michael Curry, and his emphasis on Jesus and evangelism, that has planted seeds that I think are now coming forth in ways we couldn't have imagined. You're right. It's exciting. I think in some ways, it would have been unpredictable 20 years ago. And here we have a moment and an opportunity. What if we actually could have, what if we had a winsome message?
Yeah.
And this liturgy that we all profess to love in this church, we actually did well. And we embodied that in a way that was able to bring forth that the mystery.
Yeah. Or maybe actually use the liturgy we have. This as a liturgy professor. I'm going to go right after this and go teach. And, you know, I tell my students, I say, listen, you know, you look at any of the liturgical books put together over a 50-year period, the 79 prayer book is heads and tails above them all. Like everyone can have critiques of things here and there. I do, everyone does. But I mean, put this in the scheme of things that were produced by committees in the wake of the liturgical movement, and you have a jewel. Like it's the crowning jewel of it.
It's brilliant. What I say to people is it doesn't need, most of the time doesn't need enhancement. Here's the thing. Say what's in black, do what's in red. You know, there's always innovation is always a good thing. But you're right, it's a jewel, it's a treasure. And I think things like our burial rite are just stunning as they are.
Today's episode is brought to you in part by the Poetry for All podcast. Poetry for All features award-winning teachers talking about poems, poems that transform, enliven, challenge, enrich us. It opens the world of poetry to everyone through a simple approach. So in each episode, the host will read a poem, discuss it with a guest, and then they'll read it one more time. They take a stance of wonder toward each work, while helping others into the many different experiences that a great poem might elicit. The podcast has thousands of listeners and a growing audience, and it covers classics like Shakespeare, Wheatley, and Whitman, alongside contemporary voices like poet laureate Ada Limón, Joy Harjo, and Carl Phillips. Whether you already love poetry or you're trying to figure it out for the first time, give it a listen. You can find Poetry for All wherever you get podcasts.
I'd like to shift gears here and step back a little bit and think more at the universal level. So, I mean, something that has animated theological debate from a very early point in the church's history was the relationship between the local and the universal. And we were already talking about that, about sort of diocese to the national church, or however we want to describe that. But then we're also part of something larger. So we're in a period where there's been a great deal of leadership change in the global Anglican Communion. The Archbishop of Canterbury recently resigned, which was, I mean, a pretty singular event. There have been many new primates in the Anglican Communion. The newest province of Mozambique and Angola elected the youngest primate, 43, just 6 years younger than you, at least when you were elected. I don't know when your birthday is.
Yes. Yeah.
In Chile, in the Indian Ocean, in Japan, in the Philippines, Canada will elect a new primate this year. And then, you know, the ACNA just elected its third archbishop, and obviously they're not an official member of the Anglican Communion, but a great deal of the Anglican Communion treats them as a full and equal player, which is itself a complicated, you know, reality. So a couple questions maybe in this area, and I'm going to give just a little more background here for the listeners. So The Inter-Anglican Standing Committee on Unity, Faith, and Order just issued a very significant new paper looking about how we deal with significant disagreements and thinking about ecclesiological structures. Mm-hmm. So theology and structure, treating them as necessarily intertwined. So a couple of the things it said, it highlights that deep communion can't be forced. It has to be sought and it has to be received. It also suggests that the Anglican Communion is actually a federation and that the See of Canterbury might no longer be a necessity for membership in the communion, which is probably one of the most radical pieces of it. And it also commends our freedom, that is the freedom of the members of the Anglican Communion, and even the necessity to deepen relationships by choice across the communion. Mm-hmm. So a couple questions related to this. Maybe first, what do you want the bishops of the Anglican Communion to know about you as the primate of the Episcopal Church?
I want my fellow bishops in the communion to know that I love Jesus as my Lord and Savior. That's my core conviction. And that's what matters. That I have given myself fully to that and really understand myself to be under the Lordship of Christ. And that is the most important thing to me.
Maybe a more difficult question. How would you articulate your vision for a rich and healthy Anglican communion? And maybe related to that, your vision for the relationship of the Episcopal Church specifically to the wider communion in all of its complexity and diversity.
The key, I think, insight about communion, and something we know, but I think to have it articulated in this way is important, that the communion can't be forced. That it is a gift from God that we receive as the body of Christ. I'm very taken by thinking about communion and what that means. I'm very influenced by people like John Zazoulas and others on the matter of ecclesiology and what communion is about, and also from our Anglican heritage as well. But I think of the Anglican Communion really, I mean, I know the reference is a federation. I think sort of a more of as a family of churches than a federation. But okay, so we're called to deeper relationships with each other, especially when we disagree. We've always held a creative tension between autonomy and interdependence. I sometimes like to look at the Orthodox and think about issues like autocephaly as we look at our own. I think that's a closer analog, so it allows me to look outside our own and see how others handle that tension between autonomy and interdependence. I think we can continue to hold that tension as we consider mission and ministry in our context. But these relationships and their potential to amplify our ministry, I think, are evidence that our historic ties and our structures aren't the most important things about us. They're critical, and we want to foster them. But it is this deeper work of being called into communion that is important. I think part of my vision of the Anglican Communion, really, it starts and ends with our shared faith in Jesus Christ, in the gospel of Jesus Christ, the scripture and the authority of scripture, tradition, reason, that the Nicene and Apostles' Creed, our prayer book traditions, and our liturgy follows Jesus' life and ministry. So we read and preach about Jesus, pray and worship Jesus, tell Jesus good news to the world. We aren't just talking about the nice teachings and stories and miracles, but about a shared faith in incarnation, perfect life, death, resurrection, ascension, and ultimately return. So this is powerful and deep in our communion with each other. I think I'm pursuing this kind of deep communion based on our shared faith within the Episcopal Church, and I hope to be able to bring that to my own work and part in the Anglican Communion with other primates and provinces. Again, in the Episcopal Church, I think the work of this communion across difference is a fabulous example of deep communion being sought. And so I think the Episcopal Church needs more of that vision, and I think the Anglican Communion does.
One of the principles that arose in the ecumenical movement in the 20th century was this recognition that relationships are essential to this work. And I think that this can be dismissed as a sort of like shallow, touchy-feely sort of thing. But I think it's anything but that. I mean, so two summers ago, my parents took my sister and I and our families to Southern Africa. We had spent time living with missionaries as a kid growing up two summers, and they wanted their grandkids to have that experience. And during part of that, we spent the morning with a congregation in Victoria Falls. Zimbabwe is where we had spent the time, so we were able to be there. And that experience of worshiping with that community was the highlight of everyone in my family, even though most of them are not Anglican. It was this sense of a deep communion with these people that they had never met. It's hard to put words around, but that experience gives you a kind of fire in your belly.
Yes.
That you begin to have this deep awareness that deep division with these people is a scandal to the gospel of Jesus Christ and like yes. grieves the heart of God. So these encounters with people from the other parts of the communion, this is absolutely essential. As Paul said, do not give up meeting together. This is right. This is so essential because there's a peculiar experience of Jesus that only happens in this kind of human-to-human encounter.
I agree. And you're right to say that it can be dismissed as kind of a touchy-feely. But I think when that happens, it's because we're connecting without a purpose. So you can have all the relationships, but if you have no purpose to the connection, then it is kind of meaningless. But if you can find deep purpose in the relationships, and we can actually then draw on those relationships to become not only closer to God, but to the world that God has created, now we're on to something. So think of the times in which the communion, for example, has found unity in service to God's mission. I'm thinking in responding to the AIDS crisis. In 1998, I mean, people remember all the fighting about human sexuality from 1998, but one of the keys was advocating debt relief for the world's poorest countries. And there was some real work done in that. So,
and that was not a liberal conservative
no.
question there. I mean, think of George Bush, and all of his, yes. him and Bono together doing right. all of this work that was not seen by conservatives as a liberal thing. It was a human thing.
It was human. And that came out of relationships. And we were able to do something with it. I think there's more to be done there if we could get out of our own way. You know, if we don't have to be right about everything, and if we don't have to be more righteous than the next one, or more performatively self-righteous than the next one, which we're good at in this church, what if we could, you know, see beyond? I think these relationships across the communion could be world-changing.
Yeah.
If we could find a way to be part of it. And so I think the Nairobi-Cairo Accords give us, you know, kind of a look into a way to do that. They gave us some really interesting things to think about. But ultimately, I'm about the transformation that comes from those relationships and the good we can do together.
Well, I hope the Episcopal Church can give a rich and thoughtful response or exchange to that text.
I do too. I really think like the proposal of a sharing primacy in a post-colonial context, really interesting what that might mean and what's the role of the ACC going forward. So anyway, I think this is good work.
In your speech to the House of Deputies when you were elected, you called for, I'm going to quote here, a kind of relational jubilee. That really stuck out at me in that moment, in which we can let go of the resentment, anger, and grudges that have weakened our leadership in this church during these pandemic and post-pandemic years. One group of Christians with whom there has been deep pain on both sides, and where, dare I say, there were probably folks on both sides to blame, is with the Anglican Church in North America, the ACNA. What do you hope that the leadership of the ACNA knows about you? And this is maybe going out on a limb. What do you think a relational jubilee mm-hmm. could look like with them?
Well, I'd want leaders in ACNA to know the same thing. I'd want the, well, I was in the Anglican Communion, that I'm sold out to Jesus Christ and the power of the resurrection. That's my primary identity. So, you know, thinking more closely to your question, I think, you know, we recognize ACNA as siblings in Christ, value our common heritage. I don't think we want or need to be in competition. I do think that the Anglican ideal is that there's one church in a place without overlapping jurisdictions. We don't always reach that ideal because we're human beings and we just don't. So what I would say is I welcome ecumenical conversations, prayer with ACNA and other Anglican churches. I look at the work and think about the work my friend and colleague Ruth Woodliffe Stanley's doing in South Carolina as an excellent example of how we build relationships. I mean, I think she has just done brilliant, and her ACNA counterpart, and she have what a beautiful example and witness to the gospel that they have been able to bring out of a legal entanglement. Right?
Yes.
They've managed to. I think it's an icon. Of yep. how it could be. So I look to her and I look to her counterpart there.
Yeah. I just ran into him a couple weeks ago and I said, and I commended him for this. I said, this is a really beautiful witness.
It is.
He told me that they had dinner quarterly as couples and that he's very intentional about this. And I just think that is, it's beautiful, but it's not beautiful in a saccharine way, but in a deep way.
It's the kind of communion we're talking about.
Yes.
I would get that their core convictions are probably closer than they are apart. Now, I mean, they that's not to gloss over some deep theological disagreement, but that's to be worked out and that's to be discerned together. The core convictions are there. So I think at the same time, the Episcopal Church is the historic presence in the U.S. and the other countries where we are. I don't think displacing that is the way to go, and I don't think that's anybody's goal either. I think part of reconciliation is telling the truth. I think there is deep pain on both sides, and I think can we have this kind of reconciliation, acknowledging that pain without rewriting history, right? So
yeah.
The issue is that some of these wounds, they're not just institutional, but they're deeply personal. And what I'm hoping is that newer generations that did not experience the kind of personal pain,
yeah,
we can see a different something else emerge.
I think that's exactly true. I mean, there's lots of ordinands in the ACNA who have no memory of this. It's where they encountered Anglicanism, and then they encounter a leader of another generation, and they feel the vitriol, and they're right. deeply confused. They're like, "What? What are you talking about?" And I think there's probably also similar on the Episcopal Church
sure.
side, who, you know, they meet their local counterpart and they're like, oh, this person doesn't wake up and think like, I hate that other person across town. Right, right. And then they start having lunch, you know, every other month and realize we're partners in the gospel.
Well, the fact is we were, you know, in many ways, and I think in many ways it was a poor witness, but we were at war with each other.
Yeah.
And we aren't and don't need to be. And it was, we have to figure out how do we move forward. So I think that will not be through relitigating our past grievances, but a commitment to Jesus Christ. And that is the center. And so we don't have to sit around and pretend we don't have real differences or try to force a false unity, but we can acknowledge what's at our core. And I think a relational jubilee would look like acknowledging that pain honestly, seeing how we could release the resentment that keeps us from seeing each other as fellow Christians, assuming best intent. And I think ultimately if full reconciliation is ever to come, and I think it has to, at least from an eschatological perspective, it won't be through grand institutional gestures and canonical changes, as much as it grieves my heart to say that about canonical changes. But I think through local relationships and trust and a shared commitment to the gospel, and which I think ultimately is what matters.
I think that's probably a great place to end our conversation. I've been speaking to the Most Reverend Sean Rowe, presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. Bishop Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. Don't forget to snag your tickets for the Tending the Vineyard Church Growth Conference, 15% off, only through March 31st, 2025. Go to livingchurch.org/events to register. And in 2 weeks, come on back, we've got a really lovely chat with Swedish Lutheran and full communion partner, the Reverend Magnus Persson, about cleaning closets, Swedish saunas, and his journey from charismatic success to priestly divestment. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.